That was cool, huh, guys? Yeah, we
Still
had
running.
to do that because Joel, unfortunately, is in Tehran right now where all the power went out in the entire country. So his internet's not working too well over there. And we have him on a satellite feed. Al Jazeera cell phone company or something. No, that's not true. His internet is out, but he's not in Tehran. But we're going to talk about that today. And of course, as you guys can see, we have our really good friend Mondo Gonzalez back with us today. We're going to talk about a lot of these things, which is why I have the square root clock on there, because he's one of the few people who can figure it out. You know, because you know what my favorite part about Mondo is? Not only is he funny, but he sends me these cool shots of all the stars that I can send to flurfs around the world and say, look, my buddy took this. Now what? Anyway, welcome to the show, Mondo. JD, it's good to see you. From time to time, you may or may not slip into consciousness here. So we're just going to talk over you sometimes.
Okay, that's fine. While I'm here, I did, you know, I wanted to say this. Mondo Gonzalez was saved at 18 years old in 1993. And he immediately began to grow in his understanding of prophecy. And as a teenager, he began to collect newspaper articles and a binder that connected biblical prophecy and used it as an evangelism tool. That's pretty cool. But then he realized the binder was too little. Guess what? he had the privilege of being called as a pastor in Illinois and attended Moody Bible Institute, majored in Jewish studies under Michael, and don't have to tell me the last name, I'm not even going to try it. Which provided solid instruction, not only about Jewish studies, but evangelism. I could go on and on and on here. I've got this big thing here, and it's incredible, the amount of stuff that you got. I'm just going to say, this guy knows what he's talking about, and he is on Prophecy Watchers, and I have the privilege of watching that occasionally myself. I wish I could watch it every day, because I know you guys update it every day.
And yeah, more than once.
Incredible. It's incredible. He also corrected me on the red heifers.
He does that a lot.
In the last show. And, you know, I should have known, Mondo, the thing was plastic, for goodness sake. I should have known. Okay.
Wasn't it fiberglass?
All right. That's it for me. I'm going to back off.
Well, I don't believe that for a second, but we're going to have a great show today. We're going to talk about some of the crazy things going on. I know on our last show, we talked about, you know, how close the rapture is, because a la Wolverud, you know, when you see the Christmas decorations go up, you know, Thanksgiving's around the corner. And I was just reading it. Where is it? The Thessalonians, where it says, he's like, you know, the falling away. I wanted to get some insight on that, too, because the falling away was actually, you know, apostasia, which on earlier English versions before Jimmy wanted to really nail it to the Catholic Church, the falling away, but it really means departing. And he's like, hey, so there they are. And they're like, hey, the day of the Lord came. We missed the rapture. And Paul's like, hold on a second here. You're going to see the departing first, then the Antichrist, then the day of the Lord. But I wanted to see your take on that, Mondo, as far as the falling away, because a lot of people say it's the falling away now of the church. I kind of have a different view that it's actually the departing. I think we're going to see the rapture first. What are your thoughts on it?
Well, I have a lot of thoughts on that. The presentation on that in one of our recent conferences, but I'm going to take a middle view in that there are two major views, as you mentioned. One of them is that it is a falling away or an apostasy of the church. Mm-hmm. And that goes along with 1 Timothy 4:1, that in the latter days, many will depart from the faith. So you have some correlation there. The other view is that the word apostasia refers to a physical departure, and then within that logical, conclusion is that this is a reference to the actual physical departure of the church in the rapture. I think originally I would say, you know, a few years ago, 5, 6, 10 years ago, I used to lean towards the physical departure view, and then few years ago, Lee Brainerd came out with his book on apostasia, where I think he answers all the linguistics, the history, that, you know, the church, what you just mentioned, the church, the English translations, as well as the church. I think he made an overwhelming case that it cannot refer to a physical departure of the church based on linguistics. But people could get his book on that apostasia. But my view is a little bit different, because I actually think that, you know, several of the things that Dr. Andy Woods, who I respect highly, he brought up, he believes that it's a physical departure of the rapture. And one of the things, he wrote an article for a magazine a few years ago, and one of the things he mentioned in there is that when it says the apostasia, the departure, it's a definite article in the Greek. And so it makes it pretty challenging to say, if it refers to an apostasy of the church, well, how would you know when that takes place? Because we know that 1 Timothy 4 is very clearly that there's a departing in the latter days. But there is no definitive moment of the apostasy of the church. It began happening in the 1850s in the seminaries and mainline denominations. And so how would you ever know that the apostasia happened, the departure happened in a moment? And so I think he makes a great argument against the idea that it's the apostasy of the church. So the short story is, I actually think it's referring to, within the context of the passage, especially verse 4, I think the apostasy is the Jewish people. When they make an agreement with the Antichrist, they are making an apostate decision to align themselves with a false Christ, and that would solve the problem of not being a church departure, because how would you know that? But if there is a singular departure by the Jewish people with the Antichrist, which again, all those things line up, it would fit very nicely, because right there in the verse, it talks about the man of sin being revealed in verse 3, and then into verse 4, it discusses him sitting in the temple of God, which is Jewish. And so I think that the day, and we know as well that it says the day of the Lord cannot be present unless the apostasy happens first and the man of sin is revealed. And so we know that what starts the day of the Lord, the tribulation period, it's a covenant with the Antichrist. We know in Daniel 9:27. So I think the apostasy fits very nicely with that. But this is kind of a short answer, because I developed it further. But again, I'm not dogmatic on it. There's a lot of different opinions. So there's three main opinions on it, but nevertheless, we do know that the church is going to depart from the faith, because of 1 Timothy 4:1. So we don't need 2 Thessalonians 2:3 for that, because we're certainly observing the church having fallen away, living in the age of Laodicea. Very, very sad, no doubt.
Well, that's interesting. I think the key thing is that the day of the Lord, people think that's the rapture. It's not. That's the second coming, right?
Right.
So we did that. But here we are. We just had a show talking about how close we are to the rapture and all these different things that are happening, and we're talking about the earthquakes and all the things that are going on in Israel. So here we are. You know, we're recording this right in the middle of August of 24. Crazy things are happening, and I'm telling you that because it literally changes minute by minute now. So I've been saved since I was 15 and started looking for things back then, and you really had to go search for things and say, oh, look, there's a piece of prophecy, you know, and then a couple months later, you might find another one, and when we're here, and now it's like a fire hose. It's like, okay, well, wow, look at this, and then look at this, and look at this. So what are some of the things you're seeing today, Mondo, as far as, like, the prophecy of Israel doing what they're doing, Gog and Magog, now Ukraine invades Russia, and it's like, what's that going to cause? Because, like, Derek, you know Derek, he believes that the Gog and Magog is, the hook in the jaw is not oil, it's something else. So I'd like to get your take on that and where we are in our time frame.
Yeah, no, that's very interesting. I'm going to be doing a presentation here in a few weeks, actually, in California, for Brandon Holthouse. It was the conference on geopolitics. And one of the things that I'm going to develop there a little bit more is what you just asked, the chronology, because, you know, we have certain markers within the biblical narrative. One of them certainly is the second coming, right? All Israel will be saved. And so we know that's the goal as well for the Lord. He wants to save Israel. And so I think if we look at some of those prophetic markers that we know for sure, again, at the end of the tribulation, Israel gets saved. And we know a little bit before, in the midpoint of the tribulation, that they take flight. Jesus says, if you're in Judea, when you see the abomination of desolation, flee for your lives. Don't even go down to grab your coat. So, and get out of town. So we see that that Matthew 24:15 passage in 16 aligns quite nicely with Revelation 12, where the Antichrist comes into play, and then he sends a flood after Israel, the woman, in Revelation 12, and then he begins to chase her and to seek her for 42 months or 3.5 years. So we know that the last 3.5 years is very, very problematic for the people of Israel. Again, they're fleeing for their lives. We know as well from Zechariah 13, 8, 9, that two-thirds of Israel is going to be killed in this devastation by the persecution of the Antichrist. So if you kind of go backwards, you could see, well, then where does, you know, where does Israel's, with the geopolitics there, where does Ezekiel 38 come into play? Because if you go back to the first part, the signing of the covenant, the start of the 70th week of Daniel, we know that they somehow come under the protection of this Antichrist figure who makes a covenant with them. You know, Daniel 9:27, the Hebrew is it can actually be translated that he causes to prevail a covenant for the people. And so you have this idea that what covenant is he prevailing in the land? I actually think it's a reference to the other places in Daniel. It's a reference to the Mosaic covenant, which again is very nice, ties into the temple. And so, which ties in again, Daniel 9:27, sacrifices. And so context is very, very important there.
I lean in that direction too.
Yeah. So if you go backwards, you see, okay, what's happening now? Let me just say this. So right now, if you look at Israel, you know, people have gone to Israel, you see that 80% of Israel is secular. I mean, they just are. They don't care about a temple. In fact, there's this major tension between the secular Israelis and the religious, the other 20%. Because why? Well, the religious, their kids, their children don't have to serve in the military. They're not conscripted. Every other secular person does, boy or girl. So you also have the religious. They get paid from the government to study Torah. And so you have, and they want a temple. They want this idea. And the secular people don't care about a temple. And so, in fact, this tension has been there for a long time in that when you look at the story, imagine you're a secular Israeli and your daughter is in the military, your son. And that, and these quote, crazy, wacko religious right, they want to build their temple and start World War III with the Muslims. And then who's going to have to fight in that war? Well, it's going to be my kid. Who's going to have to go fight for this ridiculous religious temple that I don't even care about? It means nothing to me. So their kids aren't going to be killed for it. So you have this, again, this tension. But the question that comes up is this, that at the time of the confirmation or the making of the covenant, in Daniel 9:27, the 20% of Israel, why was still, that's not a lot. So why is Israel going to even care about the covenant sacrifices or the Mosaic covenant and doing it else? Something has to change. And I think what has to change or what's going to bring about change is what you just said, Ezekiel 38. So imagine, again, we have these truths, you know, again, the end of the tribulation, the midpoint, the start, Ezekiel 38. So we don't know exactly when all these are going to take place. But what we do know is Ezekiel 38 says, after God miraculously rescues Israel and saves them from the Gog Magog coalition, it says, then they shall know. So my speculation, which again, all we can do, is that that's going to happen right prior to the start of the 70th week of Daniel where the covenant is signed, because imagine for a moment that you have, it doesn't mean they get saved, but you have a switch that all of a sudden the secular people see God rescue them. Supernatural. You know, I mean, they're going to be like, so this idea of God being there is real. This existence of God, this theism is going to come to play. And they're going to be now spiritually hungry, looking for answers. The rabbis are going to say, we need a temple. So you're going to have, I think you're going to have a shift in Israeli culture in that they're going to want something that they didn't have because of the rescue that just happened. So again, I'm speculating here. I don't know for sure. We're trying to fit it all together. But I think that would be a great marker for what changes the culture to even care about having a temple, because right now they don't.
Exactly. And then, you know, it's going to come to the point where they'll have no choice. You'll have to say this was God. There's no other way to describe it. And I think that's, you know, the crux of our show is showing all these things. Now we're seeing all the nations of the world gathering around to come against Israel, and here we are, you know, the clown show in the West going, are you coming to take a spoil? Hello? Yeah. We're like right there. and my square root clock is ticking down. So the, some of the things we see, hey, Joel, since we didn't lose you yet, you got any questions?
Well, you know, I just wanted to clarify the fact that what you're talking about is the Jews are being made aware of Jesus and the power of him when the Gog and Magog invaders are all destroyed. And that is meaning that you've got all these countries coming together all at the same time to attack Israel. And you're talking a lot about the secular people there. Well, you know, they're going to think it's over. We're done. You know, but nobody's coming to our aid. United States is not coming. Nobody's coming. We're toast. And at that moment, God comes down and saves them. Well, that's a pretty big deal. You know, and I just wanted to make a point of that to make it really clear what you're saying makes a perfect, a lot of sense.
I'm trying to think about the just the timing of it because, you know, you have this switch within the culture. And as you mentioned, we know that, I mean, the Jewish people right now, are, you know, we love them, we support them, but we also recognize, in fairness, that they're in a state of rebellion against God. They're in a state of rebellion against Jesus, for sure. And so the Orthodox Jews are actually very hostile to Christians in many ways. Itamar Ben-Gavir, the security minister, he's an Orthodox Jew. He's done a lot recently in stopping Christian missions, Christian churches, Christian ministries in the land of Israel. I mean, when you get down to the root of rabbinic Judaism, they do not like Christians and they do not like Jesus. And so it's no different than the hostility that you see in the Gospels as it relates. But we know, again, they're God's chosen people. That doesn't mean that we know according to Ezekiel 36 and 37, they've come to Israel in a state of unbelief. But we know that on that day, they're going to call upon on the name of the Lord. They're going to say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. And so Jesus will save them. But that's kind of one of the purposes of the tribulation period is to, Daniel 12:7 says, to shatter the power of the holy people. That's one of the things that's going to happen in that second half. He says that very specifically. That power, that stubbornness, that self-reliance needs to be shattered to such a degree that they will call upon him whom they have pierced and they will mourn as if their only son. So that's the goal of the tribulation. And so as we're looking and trying to fill in the gaps, we have these big pictures, these markers, but filling in, we're trying to go, how do we get from there to here to the next step, to the next stage? Mm-hmm. It's a little challenging, so we're doing our best.
Yep. And like I always say, you know, prophecy is not prognostication, okay? It's to show us the minute after it happens, look, that's what God said all the time. And it's somewhat esoteric, where he's not going to give us all the details, because then if he did, he's basically revealing his game plan. That's like, you know, our government giving us all the, hey, listen, we're going to go over and take care of country X, but we're not going to tell you how. But look for this and this and this and this. And I think, you know, that's where Jesus is. Because the same thing happened when his first coming. If he had revealed all the details, the disciples wouldn't have been asking him, are you going to take over now in Acts chapter 1? And then Satan probably would not have killed him had the details been revealed. I also see,
David, I want to jump in here real quick. Because,
yeah.
Again, going back to Mondo's bio here, you have visited Israel many times. I wish I could say I visited her once. I had the opportunity in a book, but anyway, you've been over there many times. But one thing that really stood out to me was that you also visited the island.
Yes.
Now, that is exciting to me. I'd like to know a little bit about that.
You know, it's interesting. I was there in the year 2000, and it's a, you think, oh, because he was in prison there, right? He was exiled to the island. It was a penal colony for Rome. Very, very small place. I mean, you could see and that he would be really easy to be, stuck there. And there actually is a church there that is built, of course, you know, you spot, let's throw a church up, right? Pretty typical church history. So there's a church there that commemorates his exile there. And also what's fascinating is you go down, there's a cave where allegedly he lived, and who knows, you can't prove that. But nevertheless, it's fascinating. When you go there, it's so real, because he says in Revelation 1, I am here based on the tribulations of Jesus Christ, for the testimony of Jesus Christ. And so you realize that this is the real deal. And then it was here that he, that the Lord showed up to him in his glorified state, and then of course gave him the vision of the book of Revelation. Pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm. I think that's powerful. And because there it's dark, like at night. And I said, you know, sitting there on that island with nothing else to do, you know, in my most recent talk at Hear the Watchman, I did a whole the gospel written in the stars. He literally wrote the whole contract in the stars. And that's what we see John pointing to. I saw these stars and those stars and then dragon and this and that and the other. And these were the signs that he saw written in this. It's just fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. So speaking of your...
I know that we are, we still have some time here, and I know David's running the show today, but Mondo, I want to give you an opportunity to talk a little bit about what you're into right now and, mm-hmm. and what you're that's doing with Prophecy Watchers and booking books, all that stuff. I want to give you that opportunity because it's important. It is, your audience is huge. We want our audience to join yours, and I just want to give you the opportunity to do that.
We have so much going on. We just actually had a conference last week on Alaska cruise, which was very well attended and which was great. People are hungry. We want to see what's going on, and you know, we have our Psalm 19 project where we're as David mentioned earlier, we're photographing the heavens, even though I'm called the NASA shill, that I secretly work for NASA. I'm a NASA spy somehow. Not true. But we just
although if they want to pay you, that's fine. Yeah.
I mean, we have some great pictures, so we just want to show off God's handiwork. So Psalm19project.com. People can see all of our pictures there for free. High definition. It's pretty cool. And then I have some other articles there talking about the flat earth in a very nice way, but nevertheless, I don't believe the earth is flat. And from scripture and as well as the evidence of what we see, observational science. So that's been fun. And then, you know, we have a conference coming up in Branson, Missouri, December 5th through 8th. So people can go to prophecywatchers.com, check it out. We're almost getting to the sellout point for this conference down there. It'll be live streamed as well. But yeah, we are very busy. We have another project that we are working on too. It's a documentary on the pre-trib rapture, which is in response to a documentary that was been out for a couple of years called The Seven Pre-Trib Problems, which is a pre-wrath documentary. But they make the comments in there that the pre-tribbers have not provided sufficient answers or are unable to answer whatever. So we're working on that too, because we think as we get closer, the pre-trib rapture, of course, we know is getting attacked and attacked over. A lot of the myths, there's so many myths out there. Mm. It started with Darby, etc. So anyways, we're working on it. We have a lot going on. It's been pretty tremendous. God keeps us busy.
Oh, good. Yeah, we're going to have to do like a show just on, it's not a disappearing, which we did on the last show.
But yes.
An hour is just not long enough. And, you know, we've been having this for years. And a couple of years ago, the Lord's like, did you read it? It's like, you don't just disappear. I was like, yeah, that always sounded weird. Hey, you're right. Our bodies are changed in a moment. So,
agreed. Well said. Well said. Right. Perfectly said.
Yeah.
And then we corroborate that with Matthew 27:52, where they rose from the grave. And what did they do after they rose from the grave? They walked around the holy city and presumably preached to people. And that's why the church grew so fast, because they're like, hey, Aunt Ethel got this great new body. She looks like she's 25 again. What do I care if they kill me? So, and Josephus talks about it as well. So I think that was the first fruits before the main harvest of the rapture. And we talked a little bit about that, how there's three parts to each harvest, and there's different harvests, because he has the Jews, which is a different harvest than the Christians. But each harvest has three parts, the first fruits, the main harvest, and then the gleaning at the end. And anything with gleaning, we should get into this too, has to do with the four corners. So if you hear four winds, the angels went to the four corners of the earth, the four winds, this and that, any kind of four something or other, refers to the final harvest. That's the one picking up all the stuff they left last time. So that's really interesting when talking about that as well. So we got just over 3 minutes left here. Let's talk to our audience about, this is all fun and exciting, and us geeks and nerds love to talk about all this different stuff. But the ultimate thing is we are all super dumb compared to the Lord in eternity. So we're all basically on the same level here. What is the most important thing for their salvation? And tell people, hey, this is what you're going to need to do, and time is short. Can you share something along those lines?
Absolutely. I mean, we have fun doing what we do. The Lord tells us in Mark 13:37 to be watching. So we are commanded. It's not an option. But he also tells us in Luke 19:13 that we are to occupy until he comes, to be busy working on the kingdom. And the first and foremost thing is that, you know, all these things that are happening, these prophetic events, are given to encourage us, to show us that God's on the throne. It also is meant to show us that the scripture is true as it relates to prophetic events, because they can be evaluated from just, again, a very, even a scientific perspective. We can look and see that. But most importantly, if it's true in these prophetic areas, then it's also true in the spiritual areas. I think of what Jesus said to Nicodemus. If I talk to you about earthly things and you have a hard time with that, how can I talk to you about heavenly things? And the heavenly thing here is that, you know, all these things are there because we know that Jesus is coming. And Jesus, God says that he's not willing that any should perish, that he wants all to come to repentance. So as we think about that, the goal here is to see people come to be saved. Because why? Well, we've all done things wrong. We're all sinners. We know that. We none of us are perfect. And sin requires death. And isn't that wonderful that God loves us enough that Jesus came to die for us? And so if we put our faith and trust in him, then we get to have that salvation. So that's really why we're here, is to, we see the prophetic events. It's exciting to know that the Lord's coming. But also we know as well that we have an opportunity to share the good news. That's, the good news is in contrast to the bad news, that people do die. They do go to hell. Hell is a real place. Jesus talked about it. The good news is that we can have salvation through him. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, I talk about that in my coming book, Generational Contracts. I try to pour this out, and I'll try and pour it out again too. I mean, it's a huge, huge topic, but the basics of it is this. We had an original contract. God said, okay, here, we're going to do this. You're going to live in the garden. You're going to eat this food, and you're going to take care of the garden. And that one little caveat in the terms and conditions is, don't eat that because you'll die. Oh, so what do? We go and eat it. So here we are. We have a contract that says we have to die. Jesus had to become a man in order to fulfill the contract, which is with like kinds. And that's where we're at. So we say, oh, Jesus paid for your sins. No, it's literally a contract, ladies and gentlemen. He paid with his own blood. Okay? So you do not have to pay that contract. The wages of sin is death. So we're going to get into a lot more stuff in the second half, and it's going to be a lot of fun. But if we don't make it there, make sure you receive Jesus before that, okay? Lord willing, we'll see you in a few minutes on the second half. And
from Future
out.
Story News in Rome, I'm Giles Gibson. Hamas has decided not to attend the latest round of Gaza ceasefire talks in Qatar. The group says Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is adding new conditions to reach a potential deal. From Tel Aviv, our correspondent Sarah Coates explains why there are no expectations of American, Israeli and Egyptian officials securing a breakthrough.
Hamas will not be joining in on these talks, saying it won't negotiate just to negotiate, but it is willing to meet these mediators on the sidelines after this summit. Now, we do understand that the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has somewhat softened his stance, but there is this one large sticking point still, and that is the end to the war. Benjamin Netanyahu says he wants to resume fighting in the Gaza Strip even after this initial six-week period of calm. And this is certainly something that we could not see Hamas really agreeing to.
The World Health Organization has declared the Mpox outbreak in several countries in Africa a public health emergency of international concern. The disease, which used to be called monkeypox, has killed at least 450 people just in the Democratic Republic of Congo. With more, here's Chrisoch Amringa in Kinshasa.
The declaration of Mpox as a global health emergency was made by a team of international experts following the rise in cases of the disease in the Democratic Republic of Congo and other African countries. More than 100 cases of a new strain of Mpox that was detected in eastern DRC have been reported in Burundi, Kenya, Rwanda, and Uganda. The strain, known as Clade 1B, is reported to be deadlier than the one that spread globally in 2022. International experts are warning of the further spread of the disease across the globe.
Tens of thousands of people have taken to the streets in India demanding justice for a young female medic who was brutally raped and murdered last week. A handful of protesters also clashed with police after pushing their way into the hospital in Kolkata where the murder took place. Ishan Garg reports from New Delhi.
Doctors and nurses in Kolkata are demanding an increased security presence at the R.G. Kar Medical College. The teaching hospital where the crime occurred last week has been at the center of intense agitation for the past week. The situation worsened in the early hours of Thursday when a mob ransacked the hospital, vandalizing officers and overturning police barricades. Authorities fired tear gas shells to disperse the crowd. Hundreds of doctors had gathered at the hospital at midnight in solidarity with the victim. They say the vandals came from outside the hospital and were not part of the medical staff protesting. Prime Minister Narendra Modi says he shares people's anguish and has directed state and federal officials to conclude the investigation soon and bring the perpetrators to justice.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are back with the second half. I know you're sitting there with bated breath because you just can't wait to hear what's happening in Mondo's world. And we can't either. So we had maybe 1,000 things that we wanted to talk about, but we only have 28 minutes in this section. So JD and I decided to talk about just a few things. Now, last time you were on the show, Mondo, we talked about your book, The Red Heifer, and we were informed by you that that was a plastic altar and it wasn't real, the one we had up. So we took that down. So thanks for that.
Yes, we did. Yeah. We took that down quick.
Yeah.
Yes, we did.
Yeah, this is why we have other people on to fix us. So we want to know what's up with the red heifers. Have you got any updates on that?
There is a few updates. We see that it has been, at least officially, the cows are in Shiloh, at least officially. That's the story. And then there's a woman there, Moria, who is kind of the head director of the education there at Shiloh, which is where the tabernacle stood. So the visitor center there, if people go to Israel today, they can go over there and take a look. And he has been sharing that three now of the cows have been officially disqualified. So there's two left, two remaining. So and of course, you know, they're very reluctant to speak about qualifying because the fact of the matter is that the cows, any sort of qualifying is preliminary because they were to have the ceremony 10 days from now, as an example, they would have to do a fresh analysis on that moment before to make sure that it was appropriate at the time of the ceremony. So, but we do see that. So that's interesting. We know as well that the other three cows, I mean, all these cows were $100,000 each. So they're not going to go out there and make brisket and have an expensive steak from the cow. They will put them in the breeding program because the genetics are still there for a red. Mm. You know, and so they'll put those in the Israeli breeding program, which is there. We know that there's still a couple dozen red Angus back in Texas that are being
released. So that dude made $500,000 selling those cows?
Yep, and it cost him another $250,000 to ship them on American Airlines plane. So, this was an expensive thing. And so there was a Twitter or X post here in the last few days by his name is Yigal, you know. And so, anyways, he's a journalist who was part of the Knesset actually, and he made a post. He had a picture of Rabbi Ariel up in a place in the Old City with the Temple Mount as well as the Mount of Olives in the background. And there's a picture of a cow that is there, and then he's there with what looks like one of the priests, and they're. They're basically doing a practice ceremony. So people, again, falsely were saying, oh, here it is. The ceremony is about ready to take place. No, they're just doing a practice run on it. Because what we do know is that the place, it has to happen on the Mount of Olives. Mm-hmm. So, you know, with the Mount of Olives in the background, obviously wasn't happening at that moment because it was in the background where they were in the Old City. You can tell by the background geography. But the other thing, too, is that a lot of people have asked is, could they perform the ceremony in secret? And the answer is absolutely not. It'd be impossible because the location on the Mount of Olives, if anybody has been there, you know this is a very heavy Arab area. It's very densely populated. And so imagine for a moment that you get out there and you start burning this cow with a big bonfire. I mean, this is a big bonfire. So, I mean, there's going to be smoke. Right. People are going to call the police. They're going to call the fire department. They're going to go, there's a fire.
Hey, nothing to see here. You guys go back home.
No way. There's no way they could do it secretly because then the next thing, the police are going to show up and there'd be an Arab riot because the Arabs are being inflamed by Hamas because they made a claim in January, as most people know, that one of the reasons they attacked in October was because of the cows. So it's definitely not going to happen in secret. And let me just say one last thing. This is kind of fun because, you know, I live in a conspiracy world, you know, and I would say that most conspiracies, not most, a lot of conspiracies are actually fact. So in this sense, I had a friend who was in Shiloh a few weeks ago, and I saw this with several people actually that were there. And so he was like, I was up there petting the cow. Now think about that. Online, they're saying that they're under heavy security.
Mm-hmm.
But he went up there to pet the cows. Yeah. He was told, hey, you can't pet the cows. But the fact of the matter is, the fact that he was close enough to pet the cows, he could have taken a razor blade and didn't have to kill the cow. He could have thrown a blanket over the cow, which now it's not allowed to have anything on its back or a yoke. So I'm actually a little skeptical.
Or maybe a little bleach.
That too? Absolutely. I don't know this for sure. Again, I'm speculating, but I'm skeptical that those are the legitimate cows. I actually think they might be decoys. If they're not decoys, then this is one of the most this is the worst security that you could ever imagine after spending $500,000. Think about that. Where a stranger can walk up and pet the cow. I mean, to me, something's askew there. So maybe it's just bad security, but I find that highly doubtful.
Oh,
I just think it's that it's kind of crazy that Hamas claimed that that's one of the reasons why they invaded Israel. If they don't believe in God, I mean that covers both the Jews and the Christians. If they don't believe in our God, then why are they so scared of it? I mean, I just don't get it. You know,
I don't think
if I'm not scared of somebody's, you know, like I'm not scared of their God at all. You know, so they can do whatever they want to. I don't really care. It's not going to impact my life, and it's not going to impact my eternity. So I don't know why they're so worried about it if they don't really believe it.
I don't know if it's they're worried about it as their MO is let's find a reason to fight. One of the best memes I saw that in this month so far was, and it's called The Last Arab, and he's got a sword in his foot and a sword in his hand, and he's fighting himself. Because that's what they do. The Bible says he's going to be a brawler, right? That's what the Lord said. Hey, this kid, Ishmael, he's going to be a brawler. What can I tell you? And here we are, they're, you know, what, 4,000 years later, and they're still 4, brawling.
4,000 years.
Jeez. 4,000 years. Such a crick in
the
neck.
I'll just make one comment for what Joel said, is that we know that the Jews or the Hamas does not need a reason to kill Jews. So their propaganda, you know, they're good at propaganda. So when they said that in January, it was a few months later. But we also know as well that the fact of the matter is, as it relates to the red heifers, they're trying to maintain the status quo. And whenever there's an advancement of the red heifers, and then you see like Itamar Ben-Gvir, the security minister, national security minister, as soon as they went into power in December of 22, he immediately went up on the Temple Mount. He was actually just had a little conference on the Temple Mount a couple weeks ago, which was condemned by all the people in the ministry. But he's trying to change the status quo because he says, and I think he's right, there's discrimination. The Jews can't pray, the Christians can't pray, but the Muslims can. So why is it? And sometimes even if you're a Christian, you can pray. It's not as stark. But he's trying to change the status quo of the Temple Mount itself. And that's what they're trying to keep from happening as it relates to Hamas and even the Palestinian Authority.
So
let me ask you this real quick. He supposedly went back there again just here in the last day or two during this. You're going to have to say. Netanyahu came out and said that, you know, he criticized it. He came down hard on it. Like, you know, you're messing stuff up. I'd like your input on any of that.
Well, again, what we see is on Tisha B'Av, this was the greatest outpouring of Jewish presence on the Temple Mount, really in history, in the sense of a single day. And I think there was close to 2,000 people that had gone up there. And the reason why Netanyahu was upset, I don't think Netanyahu really cares about the Palestinian plight in the sense of the Temple Mount, but he's a politician and he has a war to fight. And I would say rightfully so. He has a war to fight for the existence of Israel. It's an existential threat, what's happening right now. And he also knows that he has tremendous pressure right now and disagreements from the Biden administration. And so he has to play the part to show that he's, when you have these inflammatory actions like Ben-Gavir is doing, one of his own ministers of the government. And again, the government is held together very, very loosely. I mean, it could be split up in a moment. All you'd have to do is have one of these right religious groups withdraw their support and the whole government would collapse. So he has to do his part. He's got to at least state publicly, hey, this is wrong, this is wrong. Privately, he could say, hey, look, Ben, I agree with you. Go ahead and do it, but I'm going to condemn you publicly. So who knows what they're doing? He has to posture himself to at least be able to resist against American pressure, because they're waiting. They need weaponry for this war against Hamas, as well as the overall broad war of Lebanon and even the potential war of Iran. So he's got to do this stuff publicly, whether he officially believes it or not. He's a politician. At the end of the day, he's a politician. I actually think he's good for Israel right now, because he's standing strong and he knows what needs to happen. And that, and Hamas has to be decimated. Not a single one left. It has to happen.
Mm-hmm. Amen. Mm-hmm. Agree.
Now, with Hamas and Hezbollah, do you think, as I do, that Israel is, you know, literally planning and plotting and going to do strikes and take out like the leadership, the heads on purpose, like cutting off the head of a snake?
Absolutely. We saw what, you know, I've always been impressed with the reach of Israel. I mean, their intelligence is really, really great, as we know, around the world. And what they were able to do in Iran, where they were able to recruit people from the Iranian, their guard. I mean, the Republican Guard, which is this is pretty prestigious. And they were able to recruit a couple people within that to place two bombs underneath the bed of the Hamas leader, and then they waited till 2 a.m. in order to explode it as such that it didn't harm another Hamas leader on the floor above. So it was a very persistent strike. And since then, Iran has arrested and executed, hung over 27 people suspected of espionage. So what they're doing is very amazing, and they know that what they're looking right now, they're looking for Yinwar, the last guy. They want him bad, but he's hiding out in the tunnels, and he knows better than to come out, because they know that they need to do that, especially for the demoralization of the Hamas infrastructure, that if they can show they can get their leaders anywhere, which they are showing, then it creates a great moral victory for Israel. And again, got to remember too that there was a guy we saw, he posted a video of himself denouncing Hamas, and he went public with it. Very, very dangerous thing. Denouncing them for them stealing food, not caring about the people, etc. His body was found 2 days later.
Wow.
Yeah, I saw that.
So we are like rocket train to the end of the age here. And you know, we talk about a lot on the show is, you know, people get, you know, fear. They get the fear. They get upset. These things are happening in the world. But then, you know, on the one hand, you're saying, I want Jesus to come back. Well, he told us this is what it's going to look like. So for me, not in a horrific kind of way, but I get excited when I see these things and how it's all ramping up, because I know, not because of the things, but because that means Jesus is right around the corner. And that's what and speaking of around the corner, the whole Gog Magog thing. So clearly Ukraine is not doing anything on its own, because we know what Zelensky did before for a living. but now the latest thing is they actually invaded Russia. Now, clearly, they're using all the laundered money that we sent them for all these things with the weapons and everything else. But how do you think that ties in with the whole Gog Magog story?
You know, there's several things, and again, we have the absolute text of scripture, which we know is true, which talks about several things in Ezekiel 38. There's two main things that appear there. There are maybe three. One is, number one is the coalition. Certainly, Iran, Turkey, and Russia are the main antagonists there. They have other, you know, Libya, certainly other people that are joining in that. So we see that coalition, that alliance, is right here at the forefront. It's absolutely fascinating. You know, for people who have watched Prophecy for 20 years or more, if you go back to the late 90s, the mid-90s, when I was watching this too with my little binder, as you mentioned, at the time, I remember Chuck Missler talking about Turkey in Ezekiel 38 when he wrote his book on the Gog-Magog War. And he says, you know, Turkey's a friend of the West. They are very westernized, right. And they're part of NATO. Think about that. Enough so that they're part of NATO, and of course, all of the countries of NATO had to approve of that. So at the time, after World War I, and they became, you know, again, westernized, they lost their power of the Ottoman Empire. So you think the question back then was, how is this even possible? How is this going to happen? There are such
well,
a
Western nation. I got another one for you. I got another one for you. Iran used to be a friend of the United States. Mm-hmm. Iran once recognized Israel as a country. You know, and it wasn't until what, 1980 that switched?
78, yep.
Yeah. And then along comes Reagan. Let him out today, quick.
you see all this where, okay, number one, you have the coalition of nations. That's there. The second thing is you have this phrase, the hooks in the jaw. And then the third phrase that you have in there is the idea of you have this group that are protesting the advancement of this coalition led by Russia. And they ask the question, have you come to take spoil? So when you look at those three major pillars within the Ezekiel 38 narrative, those are facts. Now, what is the hooks in the jaw? Well, we don't really know. Even the fact that you have protesters who are saying, have you come to take spoil? That doesn't mean they're coming to take spoil. You're just having, that's what the perception is, that they're coming to take spoil. They're actually, the hook in the jaw could be something totally different. So we just don't know that. There's not enough information. But what we do know as well is that what's going on right now is Russia is losing face. Putin is really, this is giving him a black eye with Ukraine coming in and taking over. It's a very small part, certainly not even equivalent to what Russia has taken over in Ukraine proper. But the fact that they're doing it at all, this raises it up a notch in the sense of the hooks in the jaw. Is the hooks in the jaw as it relates to Putin trying to save his career? Is he getting lambasted by people within his own military establishment, his own generals saying you're not doing enough? Again, we know that he's a dictator for sure, but whatever that is, this is not going to help him keep his own reputation at stake. So is the hooks in the jaw where he needs to do something sinister down into the land of Israel? Not sure. I think there's we plenty of speculation to go around, which is fun, but I don't know if we have all the information to be too certain yet.
Well, we get our bingo cards out and we see what happens, you know?
Yep.
I never would have thought Mpox would be a thing, but I thought he was a rapper.
too true.
Mpox, what? Yeah, because that's obviously the next global thing they're trying to get on us.
That's the next pandemic.
Mm-hmm. Now, apparently, Iran and Tehran lost all its power and all its banking today. So, Joel, do you have anything to say on that?
Well, I did have a prepared deal here, David, but I can't get to it because of Optimum Service. But anyway, basically, from what I was able to get out of it, it looked like that all of the banks in Iran just couldn't operate anymore. There was a cyber
attack. Okay. I saw something like that in China, too, where they took down, I think the article said 40 banks, and then all the Chinese were, you know, screaming and yelling, where's my money? Well, obviously. So, yeah, they're just throwing that out there. They're testing it in little spots, and that's coming worldwide too, because they're going to have to use that controllable system. So, I want to, let me touch on this too, and I'm going to ask about pyramids. I think you might be fun with that.
There we go.
At Isaiah 19, I think you know where I'm going.
Okay, I know where you're going. Yeah,
but we often speculate. It's when the prophecy comes, they're all like beheading people and they're on horses and they're doing all this stuff. It's like, where's all the tanks and the rifles and the things? So was it metaphor and them us explaining it in a way where they understood? That's the only way they could, is the way they understood. Or did we actually have some kind of major EMP and knocked out all the electronics of the world and we're sent back 300 years and we are on horses and cutting people's heads off again? What are your thoughts on that?
Great question. I think that it's very hermeneutically correct to take things in a straightforward way. But we also recognize that metaphor is pretty strong. I don't know if I'd go that far as saying that when he's talking about horses and bucklers and shields and arrows and bows, that that's necessarily metaphoric. But even if it is, let's just say that it is, because it doesn't read like a metaphor. Reading like a very straightforward battle. And but even if you have a metaphor isn't a metaphor is a literary device that points to something real. And so when you look at the spirit of a metaphor, you know, whether it's a horse or a chariot as an example, a chariot is in Hebrew. Today you have the Merkava tank, okay, which is MRKV, which is where you get the same letters in Hebrew with the extra mame on there in the front. So, but the fact of the matter is, it's pointing to something real, which is weaponry and cavalry and ways to commit war. So, I wouldn't necessarily say that it automatically would affirm that we're pushed back 300 years. I don't think that's required by the text.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's pointing to something where they did the best they could with the word that was given them, and I think it's legitimate. It doesn't need to be an actual horse, so to speak.
Right. Yeah, I would lean in that direction, and specifically for this reason, that you cannot control the buying and selling of everyone in the world if, in fact, the whole grid went down. So All this cryptocurrency and banking and stuff needs to be controlled by somebody, somewhere. Okay. I think we got time for one more topic, and that's Isaiah 19:19. It says, in that day, there shall be an altar to the Lord in the midst of the land of Egypt and a pillar at the border thereof to the Lord. So a la, you know, Nephilim conspiracy, you know, realm that we're going to go into, do you think the pyramid is there? And now in the middle, it says in the middle of Egypt and at the border. So how can it be in the middle and at the border? Well, Egypt in the Hebrew is Mitzrayim, which is plural. And it was always an upper and lower Egypt back then. So it would be at the border in the middle of both of them. So that's just the text there. But do you have any insights on that? You know, in the day of the Lord, will that be an altar? And is he the capstone that goes on top that's missing right now? Is that some kind of an altar there and we're just misinterpreting it? Or do you think that's an evil thing?
You know, that's a great question, because what we do know is in other passages in Isaiah that God says something very interesting. You know, we always think in terms of my people Israel, my people Israel. And that's true. No doubt they will always have that special promise. But he also calls Assyria my people and Egypt my people. So you have these three groups that are called his people: Israel, Egypt, and Assyria, which is kind of this trifecta of nations going from Egypt through Israel all the way up to what we understand is, again, northern Iraq. The fact that it says an altar is, I would say, challenge. It would be a challenge. That would challenge the idea, even though I find it fascinating, that the Giza Plateau with the pyramid there, which, again, the pyramid is beyond human comprehension of its details. I mean, I don't see any way possible how that was done just from a human-only perspective. I think they had supernatural knowledge. It still is the most square to cardinal north that exists in the world.
Yep. So, like an eighth of an inch off or something.
Yes, it's just absolutely phenomenal. So that's assuming that, again, that there's not hasn't been some changes, micro changes within the within the again the balance of the Earth itself. Mm-hmm. So it could have been perfectly aligned at one time.
Right.
But the thing that the challenge I have there, or the at least the question, is chasing down the idea that it's an altar.
Okay.
There's mm-hmm. what I see there with the pyramid, as cool as it is. There's really no way to see it as an altar itself, because we know what an altar is specifically. Even inside, I've been inside the pyramid there. There's three of them. I've been in two of them, actually. And there's nothing in there that would show an altar. An mm-hmm. altar is meant for sacrifice. Now, during the millennial period, in that day, right? You know, that's a very specific phrase in mm-hmm. Hebrew, talking about most likely either the tribulation period, the day of the Lord, or the millennial period. So is it possible that an altar will be put there where, again, an altar is used for very specific things as it relates to offerings? And because I don't see any altar there, again, maybe there's been something there. So is the question, not the question to you, but the question that we have is in that day something that is future, mm-hmm. or is it referring to something that is in the past? That would be the way to try to get to the bottom of it, even though, again, I think the pyramid is amazingly supernatural. There's mm-hmm. no doubt about it.
Look, you're getting into something here also about UFOs. Okay, mm-hmm. I mean, I believe on Prophecy Watchers, even there was somebody talking about UFOs. You know, this was going to be the way that they're going to try to explain things away. I'd like mm-hmm. to just a little bit more on that.
Yeah, but yeah. One of the just quickly, one of the theories is that you have, Elia Marzulli says this all the time, it's kind of fun, we go up in the rapture and then they show up. And what's fascinating to me is mm-hmm. is the idea that we go up into a cloud, right? I really do think that, like as we said earlier, we're not going to instantaneously disappear. We're gonna go up just like the two witnesses do in Revelation 11. They slowly
and
ascend.
Acts
1, while
Jesus did too.
Acts 1 and 2 Kings 6, when Elijah, it says that their enemies watch them. So if we go up and they see us go into the cloud, and then all of a sudden a ship comes out, well, that would be quite a story, wouldn't it? Because then it would be clear at least their perception of the story, that we were taken into the cloud by the ship and removed, and then the ship comes out. So I find it fascinating. I think it's a very interesting scenario.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is obviously not the rapture. You know, I'm going to make that really clear. If you guys think that you know, we're going away in a spaceship, that is not happening. I promise you, it's not happening.
Don't believe it.
We get to New Jerusalem later, but that's 1,000 years from now.
That's right.
So encourage the people. We got a minute left, Mondo. So yeah, tell them to receive the Lord. Time's ticking here. Like,
you know,
time
is ticking, and we're seeing prophecy unfold. It shows us again that the Lord's return is quite soon. And now's not the time to be dilly-dallying around. It's time to be serious about God. It's time to put your faith and trust in Him. Follow Him, be first. You do not want to be left behind for this time of trouble that's coming upon the earth. This, that Jesus said, is the worst time in the history of humanity, the whole creation itself. So now is the time to be serious about it. That's why we're here, to point people to the gospel and to be saved.
Amen, amen. And, you know, on this final note, at the end of the show, I would like to encourage people, you know, don't even overthink it. I said, sometimes we overthink this whole thing. It's real simple, okay? You screwed up. Jesus came and paid off that price and bought you. He bought you, okay? So he owns you. So give your life to Him, and Lord willing, we'll see you on the next show.
Thanks again for joining us today for The Last Christian Radio Show. And be sure to tune in every Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday right here and at www.lastchristian.net. Until the trumpet sounds.
Some people won't give you the real talk on drugs, but it's time we know the facts. Fentanyl is killing people. It's a powerful opioid, often made illegally and commonly mixed with illicit drugs. It can even be pressed into counterfeit pills that resemble prescription medications. Just 2 milligrams, about the size of a few grains of sand, can potentially be lethal. This isn't an ad to scare you, but it is an ad to make you think twice. Get the facts. Go to realdealonfentanyl.com. This message is brought to you by the Ad Council.